So we pick up the master of the work a page or so into his chapter. This is the 11th chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works and the Synthesis of Yoga. Before I do that, though, someone asked me last week if we could read the first paragraph of the chapter again without commentary, just to hear the mellifluous language of Sri Aurobindo. So he opened with chapter 11, The Master of the Work. The master and mover of our works is the One, the universal and supreme, the eternal and infinite. He is the transcendent unknown or unknowable absolute, the unexpressed and unmanifested ineffable above us. But he is also the self of all beings, the master of all worlds, transcending all worlds, the light and the guide, the all-beautiful and all-blissful, the beloved and the lover. He is the cosmic spirit and all-creating energy around us. He is the immanent within us. All that is he, and he is the more than all that is. And we ourselves, though we know it not, are being of his being, force of his force, conscious with a consciousness derived from his. Even our mortal existence is made out of his substance, and there is an immortal within us that is the spark of the light and bliss that are forever. No matter whether by knowledge, works, love, or any other means, to become aware of this truth of our being, to realize it, to make it effective here or elsewhere, is the object of all yoga. Now we come to the continuation. And to set the context, of course, Sri Aurobindo is drawing much from the Bhagavad Gita throughout this discourse. And let's quote something from the third chapter of the Gita, shlokas 33 and 35, before we begin. All existences follow their nature. And what shall coercing it avail? Even the man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. Better is one's own law of works, Swadharma, though in itself faulty, than an alien law well wrought out. Death in one's own law of being is better. Perilous is it to follow an alien law. And of course, that last is repeated in the 18th chapter, 47th shloka, reiterating how important it is to the whole outlook. So Sri Aurobindo starts, the master of our works respects our nature, even when he is transforming it. He works always through the nature and not by any arbitrary caprice. You remember when he wrote the book, The Mother, that the mother, the divine Shakti, guides one according to the law of one's nature. Even according to what is apparently ignorance to us, is a seen step towards the soul. There is no mistake to the soul. There is only a learning experience. This imperfect nature of ours contains the materials of our perfection, but inchoate, distorted, misplaced, thrown together in disorder or a poor, imperfect order. All this material has to be patiently perfected, purified, reorganized, new molded, and transformed, not hacked and hewn and slain or mutilated, not obliterated by simple coercion and denial. So you can see how Sri Aurobindo is essentially defining the means and the processes of his yoga, which is world-affirming as against the world-denying ascetic traditions. This world and we who live in it are his creation and manifestation, and he deals with it and us in a way our narrow and ignorant mind cannot understand unless it falls silent and opens to a divine knowledge. This world and we who live in it. Gita, chapter 10, shloka 42. I am here in this world and everywhere. I support this entire universe with an infinitesimal portion of myself. The mind cannot understand because the mind works from divided perspectives and struggles to approach and to approximate unity but cannot achieve it. But if it stills itself, if it will be quiet, if it will fall silent, then it can be open like a flower opening to the sun. And let a radiance from above, a divine knowledge, come into it. But it will not, of its own, produce knowledge with a capital K. In our errors is the substance of a truth which labors to reveal its meaning to our groping intelligence. The human intellect cuts out the error and the truth with it, and replaces it by another half truth, half error. But the divine wisdom suffers our mistakes to continue until we are able to arrive at the truth hidden and protected under every false cover. Our sins are the misdirected steps of a seeking power that aims not at sin, but at perfection. At something that we might call a divine virtue. Often they are the veils of a quality that has to be transformed and delivered out of this ugly disguise. Otherwise, in the perfect providence of things, they would not have been suffered to exist or to continue. The master of our works is neither a blunderer, nor an indifferent witness, nor a dallier with the luxury of unneeded evils. He is wiser than our reason and wiser than our virtue. So again, being led from light to greater light, from a small path to a larger. Sri Aurobindo is describing here what he put in a pithy sentence, from the near to the far. Our nature is not only mistaken in will and ignorant in knowledge, but weak in power. But the divine force is there and will lead us if we trust in it, and it will use our deficiencies and our powers for the divine purpose. And this too echoes the Gita, chapter 4, 11. As men approach me, so I accept them to my love, Bhajami. Men follow in every way my path. If we fail in our immediate aim, he writes, it is because he has intended the failure. Often our failure or ill result is the right road to a truer issue than an immediate and complete success would have put in our reach. If we suffer, it is because something in us has to be prepared for a rarer possibility of delight. If we stumble, it is to learn in the end the secret of a more perfect walking. Let us not be in too furious a haste to acquire even peace, purity, and perfection. Peace must be ours, but not the peace of an empty or devastated nature or of slain or mutilated capacities incapable of unrest because we have made them incapable of intensity and fire and force. Purity must be our aim, but not the purity of a void or of a bleak and rigid coldness. Perfection is demanded of us, but not the perfection that can exist only by confining its scope within narrow limits or putting an arbitrary full stop to the ever-extending scroll of the infinite. Our object is to change into divine nature. But the divine nature is not a mental or moral, but a spiritual condition. Difficult to achieve, difficult even to conceive by our intelligence. The master of our work and our yoga knows the thing to be done, and we must allow him to do it in us by his own means and in his own manner. So, in the Sapta Chatushtaya, the seven quartets, Sri Aurobindo's notebook, which he kept diligently for a number of years and recorded his outline of the integral yoga, which in part has been expressed in the synthesis of yoga, starts with a quartet called Shanti Chatushtaya, the quartet of peace. And so these three things, these elements, peace, purity, and perfection, all have a role to play in the practice of an integral yoga. But Shanti for Sri Aurobindo is not the absence of movement. It's not a shrinking away from manifestation, but something which is active. It is a state of positive spiritual being, which even when it moves, retains its innate immobility, that view of Shiva as he creates the world and yet has his eyes drawn inside, always fixed on the infinite silence that he is, always drawing from that, is the picture of what Sri Aurobindo would connote, but also not simply the infinite awareness, but an active, joyous, laughing capacity to seize upon life and handle it victoriously and shape it into a fitting vehicle in which the spirit can express its love for the world, its adventure in exploring its own infinity, compressing itself into a finite form and then expanding out of it, pretending that it's the inconscient and discovering that it is actually the superconscient. So peace is necessary, but also purity. But what is purity? Shaucha, you know, is the idea that I will be stainless. I won't have any wrong movements. But this notion that comes from perhaps a limited interpretation of the Yoga Sutras to Sri Aurobindo means a positive state of integrated being in which one automatically rejects inferior movements. It's not seeking a moral perfection or moral purity. It wants to be consonant with its own nature. Krishna always behaved divinely, but his divine nature was often seen to be a greater and more positive stance in the world than the codes of Dharma and ethics would have commanded him to do. So he would behave according to the will of the Supreme and not according to man's law. And of course, the third thing here is perfection. Perfection demanded, but not the perfection that can exist only by confining its scope, you see. This is the exuberant conquest of the spirit, moving into the forms of existence, establishing the sovereignty of the spirit in the form. That the form does not dictate to the spirit what it would be, but the spirit commands. Perfection means the minute control, the perfect control of the context and of the vehicle both. And so, he says, our object is to change into the divine nature, from the ignorant nature, the divided nature, into a nature which is integrated. Integrated not simply with the context of the cosmos around us, but with the master of the work himself, with Isha, Purushottama, whatever word you throw at it. That being is what you wish to be in contact with. That being knows the way forward for each. And what we can do best to advance is to learn to be quiet and to trust and to have faith and to offer. The movement of the ignorance, he writes, is egoistic at its core, and nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half-light and half-force of our unfinished nature. It is easier to starve the ego by renouncing the impulse to act, or to kill it by cutting away from us all movement of personality. It is easier to exalt it into self-forgetfulness, immersed in a trance of peace or an ecstasy of divine love. But our more difficult problem is to liberate the true person and attain to a divine manhood, which shall be the pure vessel of a divine force and the perfect instrument of a divine action. Step after step has to be firmly taken. Difficulty after difficulty has to be entirely experienced and entirely mastered. Only the divine wisdom and power can do this for us, and it will do all if we yield to it in an entire faith, and follow and assent to its workings with a constant courage and patience. The first step on this long path is to consecrate all our works, as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. This is an attitude of the mind and heart, not too difficult to initiate, but very difficult to make absolutely sincere and all-pervasive. And this, again, you can see in Bhagavad Gita, third chapter, the 30th shloka. And again, in the 8th chapter, shlokas 51 through 53 and also 56. So that's the first step, the one of consecration. The second step is to renounce attachment to the fruit of our works. For the only true, inevitable, and utterly desirable fruit of sacrifice, the one thing needful, is the divine presence and the divine consciousness and power in us. And if that is gained, all else will be added. So Krishna says, I'll wait on that. But Gita 2:47 and also 4:20 on that. This is a transformation of the egoistic will in our vital being, our desire soul and desire nature, and it is far more difficult than the other. The third step is to get rid of the central egoism and even the ego sense of the worker. That is the most difficult transformation of all, and it cannot be perfectly done if the first two steps have not been taken. And that would be Gita 4:21. But these first steps, too, cannot be completed unless the third comes in to crown the movement and, by the extinction of egoism, eradicates the very origin of desire. So here he's moving largely through the fourth chapter of the Gita, expressing the nature of the Purushottama, the divine person. So, also in the 18th chapter, close to the end, 57, it says, devoting all yourself to me, giving up in your conscious mind all your actions into me, resorting to the yoga of will and intelligence, be always one in heart and consciousness with me. So he's saying, through the act of devotion, through the act of self-offering, through the act of knowledge, love, works, all together, live in consolidation with my being. And he continues, only when the small ego sense is rooted out from the nature, can the seeker know his true person that stands above as a portion and power of the divine and renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti. So again, back to chapter 4 and even in chapter 10, Sri Aurobindo is drawing from the Gita for part of the substance of what he's marshaling into form here. Renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti. So this is not a passive state. This is not a state of withdrawn peace where you sit in a trance devoid of activity in the world. If you're going to live in the will of the divine Shakti, you will work. You will perform action, but without ego, without claim to the fruit, poised in peace, a perfect vessel for her enactment of her plan. So it's interesting that we come back at the end of this little section to the reality of the divine Shakti. So I would propose that we put a bookmark here tonight, and we'll take up more next time. This is a section in Savitri in Book 1, Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, that more or less continues from where we were last week when we read. Begins on page 52. All that transpires on earth and all beyond are parts of an illimitable plan the One keeps in His heart and knows alone. Our outward happenings have their seed within, and even this random fate that imitates chance, this mass of unintelligible results, are the dumb graph of truths that work unseen. The laws of the unknown create the known. The events that shape the appearance of our lives are a cipher of subliminal quiverings, which rarely we surprise or vaguely feel, are an outcome of suppressed realities that hardly rise into material day. They are born from the spirit sun of hidden powers, digging a tunnel through emergency. But who shall pierce into the cryptic gulf and learn what deep necessity of the soul determined casual deed and consequence? Absorbed in a routine of daily acts, our eyes are fixed on an external scene. We hear the crash of the wheels of circumstance and wonder at the hidden cause of things. Yet a foreseeing knowledge might be ours, if we could take our spirit's stand within, if we could hear the muffled demon voice. Too seldom is the shadow of what must come cast in an instant on the secret sense which feels the shock of the invisible, and seldom in the few who answer give, the mighty process of the cosmic will communicates its image to our sight, identifying the world's mind with ours. Our range is fixed within the crowded arc of what we observe and touch and thought can guess, and rarely dawns the light of the unknown, waking in us the prophet and the seer. The outward and the immediate are our field. The dead past is our background and support. Mind keeps the soul prisoner. We are slaves to our acts. We cannot free our gaze to reach wisdom's sun. Inheritor of the brief animal mind, man, still a child in nature's mighty hands, in the succession of the moments lives. To a changing present is his narrow right. His memory stares back at a phantom past. The future flees before him as he moves. He sees imagined garments, not a face. Armed with a limited, precarious strength, he saves his fruits of work from adverse chance. A struggling ignorance is his wisdom's mate. He waits to see the consequence of his acts. He waits to weigh the certitude of his thoughts. He knows not what he shall achieve or when. He knows not whether at last he shall survive or end like the mastodon and the sloth, and perish from the earth where he was king. He is ignorant of the meaning of his life. He is ignorant of his high and splendid fate. Only the immortals on their deathless heights, dwelling beyond the walls of time and space, masters of living, free from the bonds of thought, who are overseers of fate and chance and will, and experts of the theorem of world need, can see the idea, the might that change time's course, come maned with light from undiscovered worlds, hear while the world toils on with its deep blind heart, the galloping hooves of the unforeseen event, bearing the superhuman rider near and impassive to earth's din and startled cry, return to the silence of the hills of God. As lightning leaps, as thunder sweeps, they pass and leave their mark on the trampled breast of life. Above the world creators stand. In the phenomenon, see its mystic source. So, namaste, Jai Ma.